Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning out there, everybody. But if you're in Upper Westchester like I am, you need your umbrella, a rain hat, and a lot more than that. It's freezing outside, and it's windy, and it's raining. But I'm hoping that it'll stop, and the weather gods will smile upon us with the sun later. But my author that's here today, Carl Brookin, says it's beautiful where he is, so maybe he would like to send some sunshine over here.
And well, I'll give it a
we're
try.
We're going to do a Sean mystery. Thanks a lot. That would help. We're going to talk about Demented Investigator Sean. Yeah, this is one of my favorite characters because he cracks me up. Has a rare quiet evening at home. The peacefulness of a summer evening in Roseville is interrupted by a call from a man whom Sean does not, he really doesn't like him. I don't blame him. Salvatore Bozzario invites Sean to the scene of a house fire in St. Paul, and thus begins Sean's reluctant search amid the hot ruins of a fire. This was sad. An 8-year-old robbery and murder and the intrusion of a traveling band of thieves who stop at little to achieve their nefarious goals. And there's a whole lot more. And, of course, you brought back my other favorite character, Catherine McKerney, as his as his girlfriend. And
his girlfriend is the love of his life.
Too,
yeah.
And I said, yes, and I said, you can't kill those two off. Sorry, no, not going to happen. And so tell us, how did you create Sean? Because this is like a guy with two first names. It's hilarious.
Well, I can't really tell you how I created his name. That just came to me in a dream or after having too much to drink or something. I don't really remember. But when I first started creating Sean, and I didn't really realize it. The very earliest novel that I was reading to my critique group. A friend of mine overheard this, and he said, you know, it sounds a lot like the guy you told us about that you lived with when you were in the Navy. And I realized that that's absolutely true. This Sean is modeled after my roommate. I had a specialized job when I was in the service, and I was stationed in Washington, D.C., and they had no accommodations for us. And we worked all different hours. And sometimes we worked all night, but they had no dormitory facilities for us, so they threw up their hands and said, "Well, we'll give you an allowance. Go live off the base." So we found an apartment. We lived off the base. It was like having a regular job, except we had to wear these funny uniforms. but it was great. Mm-hmm. And so I lived with this guy, and he was short, and he was feisty, and he was a good cook. And we had a great time together for almost the 2.5 or 3 years that we worked there. And I realized then later when people began to point out to me some of the characteristics of my detective, that he is modeled after my friend that I still keep in touch with, who actually grew up in your area. He grew up in Westfield, New York. So...
Well, that is interesting.
Yeah,
well, for those people that are short like me and feisty, this guy is good.
Are you short? You're feisty, I can tell, but are you short?
Very.
Too? I mean, I've never met you.
I'm five feet tall and I forgot to grow.
Well, you see, that's the thing. We have a tendency, we who are taller, and society is, you know, I think the average American is 5'7" or 5'8", something like that. All right, so we have a tendency to look at that level, to operate at that level, and people who are a lot taller or a lot shorter get treated a little differently. And as a result, it's been my observation that particularly short people sometimes adopt an attitude in order to compensate for being what they see as being sort of overlooked, if you know what I mean. And I don't know if you ever experienced that, but my friend certainly did, and he told me that once. He said, you know, I walk down the street and people don't notice me because I'm short. Well, he compensates. He compensates by being bright. And the other thing that he compensated for was he married, he actually married a girl who was almost 6 feet tall. He met while we were living in Washington,
D.C. That's everybody else in my family. I'm the only
right.
short one. I don't know how I got short.
That's interesting.
When I was 10, I was 5 feet tall. And they said I was going to be huge in every way.
And then you just stopped growing.
My father was tall.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they forgot to tell me that I was supposed to continue. So I've asked many times, you know, like, can you stretch me? Can I have, higher shoes? I can't even wear heels because I'm little. And I said, like, okay, this is no fun, but yeah. You don't want to start with us short people because, you know, we're tough. So it doesn't matter.
Well,
they
I believe
can say whatever
it.
They want, but then there's the rest of us.
I believe
yeah.
it.
So
I
what happens when he meets
people.
Salvatore?
Well, he
short
he,
people
see, Salvatore
people.
Is maybe a kind of a
yeah,
kind of a fringe mob guy, and so Sean doesn't like him because, in a sense, he likes him as somebody to have donuts and coffee with, but he doesn't like him as a potential client because he doesn't. Sean is not your typical big time big city PI. He has a lot of rules about things that he won't do, so he doesn't get into a lot of trouble. He's very good at what he does. He's very good with weapons, but he really hates shooting people, so he doesn't. A lot of this is because when I was a kid, a randy kid growing up, I read Richard Prather. Now, Richard Prather was a very successful genre author.
Mm.
He had billions of books in print when I was growing up, and he had a particular detective who was 6'6", who was a former Marine, who would shoot you just as soon as shoot you as look at you, and he slept around a lot. And so when I was working on this, on the first book, I thought about Richard Prather, and I thought, you know, I'd really like to do an homage to him, but I'm going to do it in the opposite way. So my detective is short. My detective doesn't shoot except when he absolutely has to, because, as he said, the recoil hurts his elbow, and he has a tall girlfriend, and he doesn't sleep around. He's not married, but he doesn't sleep around. He and Catherine McKerney are committed to each other, but she's tall, and you could say statuesque, and she knows it and likes it, and she likes the way her legs look in heels. So she wears not really high heels, but short heels when they go out sometimes. And they get a kick out of the reaction of people who see them walking down the street. And so because of this disparity in heights, in the detective stories, there's a good deal of implied humor about their relationship, just because about their physical relationship. I don't go into a lot of detail, as you know. I don't go into a lot of detail about their sexual life, but they obviously have one. I'm not writing that
kind of a book.
According
to the book, they do, people.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah.
So what is Salvatore one Sean at the scene of the fire? And how did you decide on who the victims are? That was sad.
Well, it was. I don't decide in the sense that people think. I didn't sit down and say, all right, now I have to have somebody who dies, and he's going to be this and this and this and this. When I write these books from beginning to end, I don't do a lot of outlining and a lot of preparation. These characters come to me as I'm writing. Well, and for example, I need a male. Okay, well, he'll be so and so. I need a female here because the way this scene is shaping up, I need a feminine perspective to make it really work. And those kinds of things come to me. So then I shape the book and I change things and I fool around with it and rewrite and throw stuff out and scratch on things and kick the wall sometimes when it's frustrating. But, I have a good friend who is the exact opposite. He outlines absolutely. He read his books, his outline is like 50 pages long, and he could practically just add a few things, and he's got a novel. And when he turns his books in, to his editors, they come back with almost no changes, because he does everything so precisely. And he's a really good writer, and his books are wonderful. And that's the way he works best, and that's fine. I just don't work that way. I start at the beginning of the story. That's what I tell people. I start at the beginning of the story, and the characters come, and sometimes they talk to me, and sometimes they tell me I got to go a different direction. And then when I get to the end of the tale, I stop. Mm. And that works.
You know what's really good is that you don't have 900 pages. You don't have 900 pages either, which makes it so much easier for somebody like me that's reading it.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
I know, it's
easy.
Like, okay, people, it's not 500 pages, it's 200 something,
right.
And I could read it in an hour and a half and then read it again to make sure I don't mess up the review, which is going to come out right after the show, people.
Okay.
You're all in for my wacky review, seriously speaking.
Oh.
So,
you're going to email a copy of me of that wacky review to me or something?
I will definitely send one. So you could read my brilliance today. What can I tell you?
Yeah, that'd be nice. I'd like to do
that. I try.
Well, good. I mean,
What does this have to do with mobs and gangs? Yeah.
Well, he has nothing to do with
you know, I'm sitting inside.
Huh?
No, nothing.
Nothing.
No,
see,
he doesn't. There is a gang
in this book. That a traveling gang, which is kind of modeled after those Irish thugs who run around the country and pretend to fix your driveway, but they don't. They just take your money. Anyway, so it's modeled after. There is a small gang that goes through town and does bad things, and Sean has to stop them, and that's sort of the genesis of this. Of this book, but it's mostly about the interaction between the characters, because that to me is what's fun to write about, and that's what's interesting to me. And when I'm going about the city, or I'm sitting in the Mall of America watching people, what I'm taking away from that mostly some of the physical activity, but mostly it's the verbal interaction between people. And I love overhearing people talk and making little notes. And I have a couple of really small tape recorders that allow me to record people's talk, and I can incorporate that into my books. And I really like doing that. So that's kind of the way it is.
Like fun.
It is fun. I mean, I wouldn't do it if it wasn't fun. Because it's a lot of work. Being a writer today is a lot of work. And now I'm publishing books myself, mine and other people's, and to make a little extra money. But it's not all about the money. It's really about writing stories that I hope people will enjoy, and that provide some enjoyment in the midst of a monsoon in upstate New York, and when people they can't go out and do things, they sit home and read one of my books and have a good time. See,
that's what I keep telling people, especially today. People, the case of the stolen case, it's pouring outside. Where are you going to go? So you know, you go on Amazon, you order a couple of thousand books, starting with this one.
So if it
snows or rains, you're not bored, and you could sit down. Right, and read. And besides the fact, like I've been telling all my listeners, Easter's coming, and you know what better way to celebrate Easter than with a book in the basket of Easter bunnies?
Absolutely.
And seriously.
You have a little fire in the fireplace, and just kind of warm up. And of course, if you go to my website, www.carlbrookins.com, you'll find all my other books, which you can also order from both Amazon and from my own website, things like that. Yeah,
this is very true.
Yeah,
and
so
they can get frustrated if I push you on this one at times. Yeah.
So we have all these.
Tell us about the Grand
stories.
Pharmacy.
I'm sorry.
I think I read almost everything you wrote. I'm not sure. Just about.
Oh, well,
I think I read just everything.
I've
you know what happens with
novels.
With,
and. I have
no,
another one
I
coming
don't,
out
I think
this
I read
spring.
Like about 8 or 9 of them. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, that's quite a few. I'm glad you like them. I mean, gee, that's great. That's lovely to know.
Trust me.
Fran, I trust you completely.
PJ has this thing now. Your publicist is relentless. They're all relentless. I don't have to say I want the book. It just shows up in the mail.
It shows up. She knows.
I'm serious.
She knows.
So I'll look at the email and go like, I can't take any more. And she'll just send it anyway. She doesn't care. Nobody listens to me anyway.
Yeah,
it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
And then they'll say 5 minutes later, when can you do an interview? And I go like, well, I'm doing interviews till the end of June, and then in July, I'm taking a break. That's
it. Oh, that's
I
good.
Take my break to do just reviews and.
You
yeah,
have to
yeah,
take a break.
I don't do anything
in
July, and then maybe I'll start in the end of August. Yeah, I need to rest my brain from reviews.
Absolutely. Well,
and,
see, I'll
have
review at
least books,
two more
no,
books
not
out
a,
by then. So
oh, that's even
we'll
better.
Send them to you.
I'll get them in August and September.
That's right.
True.
Okay.
So what
that's
does this
fine.
Have to do with robbery and real estate and the Grand Pharmacy robbery? That was interesting. That's an
well,
old case that's coming to the front in,
that's
in
right.
this particular
it's
one.
That's right. It's about solving an old case because there were two murders during that robbery of the pharmacy, and Sean's attitude is that those kinds of things need to be fixed. Those people are like restless ghosts out there, and they need to be have a resting place, and the way to have a resting place is for them to is for the murders to be solved. So he sets about doing that, even though he doesn't really have a client and he doesn't really get paid much money for it. This is just something that he does. So that's the you know the basis of the mystery, and he is able to do that, of course, because. He learned a trick from me that I used in a television series that I did, in which I can't reveal to you, of course, to your listeners what the trick is, but it's a trick that that a lot of school teachers use to demonstrate, to shall we say, how ping pong balls can fly around in the air. So it's a lot of fun, and that's the other thing I like to do. I like to use events and knowledge from a whole variety of sources in my book, so that people consciously learn things, but it adds texture, makes the books more interesting. I think adds pace.
Well, what does he meets this guy that is also a cagey guy, George Gatto. What does he have to do with the land there and the real estate there? Because there's a whole bunch of hidden things about this real estate deal.
That's right.
I learned about real estate scams, too. It's interesting.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm getting good at this, too.
There's a little real estate scam in there. And you, so you get a little, that's, if you take that to your own situation, you'll discover that you won't have, that you won't get scammed by some people who try to sell you a lot in Florida that's all underwater, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So all those things take place. All that kind of chicanery, all that kind of thievery takes place in the world, and we may not experience it directly, but we should know about those kinds of things. It's just, you know, and I'm right now I'm in the middle of a political thriller that I hope will help people learn a little bit more about things to look for when they're looking at candidates and things like that. So we have better politicians. Well, you know, you never know. It's just one of those.
Yeah, that
you might
want to add that one on the news today.
I have not looked at
this. That might be an interesting debate. As I'm listening. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, my God. So we have Jake Logan, and we have a whole bunch of other people. And I read the things about this real estate scam, but I'm very skeptical. I believe nothing. And if it's not told by a reputable person, just because it's in writing doesn't mean it. And they didn't see, like, the fine print. So
sure.
Who is this guy, and why were so many people fooled by him? You want to smack him in the head, this guy.
Well, yeah, but see, people get fooled because the people they're talking to talk nice, look nice, act nice, and I mean, people who are really nice to you, they can't be criminals. They're really nice. See, and we forget that sometimes criminals, not all criminals are like Al Capone,
yeah.
You know, thugs. Especially today, criminals are not. You get calls all the time, I'm sure. I get endless phone calls from people who want to sell me stuff that I don't need, can't use, and don't want to pay for. And it gets to be a waste of time to even to answer the phone at times. So I'm thinking about writing.
I have a thing now. I block these people from calling.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I block them from calling. As a matter of fact, I learned that anybody with a 91, you get a 917 number, and then
yeah,
you get somebody
right.
whose name is on there that's not even the person that's calling you, and it's a tape,
right.
and I just delete them and block them. That and any political party that annoys me.
Yeah. Well, that's right. On the other, and that works. But at the same time, I'm endlessly curious. So sometimes I pick up the phone and I answer these calls. And when I discover it's a real scam, I sometimes say, "Wait a minute, I have to turn on my recorder for the police department." And then they usually hang up.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So
well, I do you know things like, "Oh, Sergeant somebody is on the phone," and you know whatever. That's just the point.
Right.
I'd gotten a prank phone call, and they said, when you get calls like that, you just say, "Sergeant Jones on the phone, can I help you?" And make them
yeah.
seem as if you're somebody from the police department. What can I tell?
That's right.
So, I you know, so let's talk about Catherine, and she sticks with Sean no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And how does she help him as an investigator? She's a cool character. You can't
well,
pull
you
her off either, sorry.
Right. And he investigates because he has this innate curiosity, and when people come in with these problems, he wants to help them. He has to make a little money, of course, but so he has to charge people like any private detective does. But he's not greedy, and so in my books, he does other things as well. You know, he takes other kinds of jobs that I get to describe, and I kind of enjoy that. My life has been involved in a lot of different things, from the service to the academic world to the television world, things like that. And out of all those experiences, various events happen, and I get to, in the because I'm writing about them, I get to write about them. And when I write about them, I get to dress them up a little bit, and sometimes add stuff like car chases and people running around, and all of that adds, I hope, to the interest in people reading the books, and it means that I get to talk about all these things that have happened in my life, and that's fun to do. So Mason, the basic idea is to do this and have fun as well as make a little money at it, huh?
That would be nice too. I was so excited the other day because on my 13th book I got a royalty check, and
yeah.
I write from the point of view of the dead body behind the gravestone, Hidden Truths and Lies by me. And some of them are based on real life events, but I can't tell people which ones they are, but yeah, they are.
Sure.
And I'm writing the fifth one, and I got this check. It wasn't huge. I got so excited.
Yeah.
I said, gee, it doesn't even break this much, but yay, I got yay. The scary part is that you don't get a lot of money from the royalties. And I was sold like about 20 books, and I said, oh my God, I got $26. I'm so excited. It's just like, huh?
Well,
but,
yeah, but it's.
Well, I got
but
a
little
surprised because I didn't think.
Right, but what happens is that you know now that 26 people are interested in your book and they're reading it. And at least probably 27 of them will really like it, and they'll give it to somebody else and they'll read it. And, you know, it's nice to know that there are people out there reading your books, reading your stories, and enjoying themselves because of it. And that's, you know, that's a contribution to the world.
I hope so.
Good.
But at the Thriller Fest last year, I gave one to one of the most famous authors, but I don't know what he thought. But he actually took it. R.L. Stein took one of my
mm-hmm.
books. And I was like, I don't have no idea what he thought. I'm sure when I go to the film
yeah.
fest, maybe he'll tell me if he read it.
Well,
but he
someday,
it.
Someday he'll remember saying,
so
I better
cool.
call Fran and tell her that I liked your book. But it doesn't mean
yeah,
they didn't.
Maybe.
See, that's,
but
that's,
he knows me when I walk in.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that's good.
Well, there were
a
band of
in.
Thieves, we said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So before I forget, and I don't want to forget, I'm on the air Thursday with Jeffrey Wells, and the book is in front of me, so I got the title right, Atone for the Ivory Cloud. And that's kind of a lot of music and composition and stuff like that, because I'm a music person.
Interesting title.
So that was interesting. And then on 4-3, we got about a Navajo school, Terry Wineski, Belladonna, Belladonna.
Uh-huh.
On the 5th, I've got Jill Rosenblatt, The Fixer, uh-huh. The Killing Kind. And on the 6th, I got one of my other favorite people with a wacky character, Swan's Way Out by Charles Sosberg. That should be
You have eclectic taste.
And I've got Silence. Yeah, he's a trip and a half. I met him last year for the first time. He's really funny. And then to round out April, I have Silent Source by Robert James Smith. And that's an Ed Scary book. And February 424, Steve Berry, my lost daughter.
That's
and
quite
that's
a lineup.
Some of the mischief that I'm going to be up to. I never know who's going to say yes to anything, and then.
Of course.
Yeah, and the greatest lineup, of course, is I was shocked, but I'm going to do it. I'm so excited. May 9th, the head writer of Murder, She Wrote, Tom Sawyer. I'm going to talk to him about his memoirs and two books. So. We have poor Catherine, and she gets a scary phone call, and she disappears. So what does he do when he finds out she's targeted? He's fuming. I mean, it doesn't matter
sure.
how tall Sean is, he's going to get whoever did this.
That's good. All right, and presumably she will. Yeah, okay, that's fine. That's an intriguing idea.
Yeah.
You don't know what was in the phone call that caused her to disappear. Yeah, that's really interesting. Well.
That's right. Well, you have to be careful with those phone calls and you don't know. So we've got George Peachy. And he realizes, this is the first one, that he's been ripped off in the pharmacy murder. Do you have George? The guy
right.
who gets
yeah.
killed.
Mm-hmm.
George
Peachy. Yep.
George. And he realizes he's been ripped off, so did he serve time for prison for murder? And what cash are they looking for, and who else is involved in this one?
Those are all good questions.
Oh, okay.
All
don't
good questions.
Okay. I'll come to one that... Okay, my other question is, I want to ask about the people that are in the scheme. So why is Sal acting weird? And all of a sudden, we have to talk about the suitcase. He asks Sean to find the suitcase. Why does he ask
right.
him to find the suitcase?
Because
and
he knows there's
sudden,
something in the suitcase.
He doesn't really care if he finds it anymore.
Well, he does and he doesn't. I mean, it starts out he cares because there may be money in it, and there may be things that implicate him in the robbery at the pharmacy. See, so he's worried about his rear. He's worried about how he may be implicated. I mean, he's got all these scams going in St. Paul. You know, he runs his real estate company, and so Sal is. But because Sal has acquaintances, I won't call them friends exactly, but acquaintances who are connected
mm-hmm.
to organized crime, he's worried now. Begins to be worried about whether things he's hearing on the street are that he might be implicated in this old 6-year-old. The robbery at the pharmacy, and he doesn't want anything. So he wants Sean to find the case so he can see what's in it, in the hopes that when he finds it, it'll exonerate him. But later, as things go on, it becomes clear to him that he's not involved. So he just kind of disappears. But Sean is now stuck with these people who want to get rid of him because he knows about the case. So he has to take them down. He, of course, as he always does, he enlists the police in his efforts because, as he says, I can do certain things the cops can't do, and the cops have a lot of resources that I don't have. So why can't I be friends with cops? See, that's the other thing. Most private detectives in the mystery genre have adversarial relationships with the police that they're hanging around. Well, here in the Twin Cities. If you're a PI and you don't and you go outside, you know, I live in a small community, not very small, just north of the Twin Cities, there are something like 47 different law enforcement agencies within almost within walking distance. So if I'm a PI, I gotta have relationships. I gotta know all those people, so I can get things done when I need to get things done without getting arrested. And that means that the officers have to have a relationship with me. So my detective spends a lot of time cultivating these activities. I don't write about all of them, of course, but because that would be boring. But he does.
Mm-hmm.
Have good relationships with the cops that he knows, because he can sometimes do things for them that they can't really do themselves.
So do you ever connect with any of these law enforcement people? Because I know a lot of the authors that I work with, you know, are lucky because they have
yeah.
these contacts.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I had
I
asked the
yeah.
fire department here to help me with something with arson, and the
sure.
fire, they said call the fire chief, and I was very disappointed that he didn't call back, and
oh.
I was, you know, because I had to wind up having
yeah.
to use another source. And then I was lucky because I wanted to kill off somebody with a specific drug, and
mm-hmm.
I went into two pharmacies and they gave me, you know, all the printouts and stuff, so I would be able to use it. And then they
good.
Explained
yeah.
which one I should
yeah.
use. It was so cool.
Yeah.
I listed them as my, you know, medical advisors. I think that's so cool, though. But you can't do it all the time.
You can't, but most professionals I've found are eager to talk to you because they don't want you to get it wrong. So I've never had any trouble, and I have two or three police officers. When I was working as a counselor and teacher at a local college, I taught a lot of cops, and so I have contacts with them as well. And so, you know, and I've done some ride-alongs, and I've been to some of their seminars, and I spoke to the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Convention once and things like that. So I have these contacts, and so I can call up people and say, yeah, what about this? Because you need to get things right. And I've never found a professional who wasn't willing to explain some odd area of his job, his or her job, that makes the stories more interesting. You know, rather than make it up, that's a lot more interesting.
Well, I
it
agree
takes
with
time.
You. It's just that.
Yeah, it's called research.
I mean, I walked up to a sanitation. I walked up to a sanitation worker the other day and asked him a couple of questions, and
yeah.
if it wasn't so cold, I probably would have gotten some more answers. He was really nice, but
yeah.
when you ask the police department, you have to go through the special officer, and you have to call there and whatever. I said, can you just answer my question? I'm talking to you right now.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
it's like, I don't know.
Well, they do have to worry about their public relations. But I've discovered that in the places where I've had several questions, that eventually they'll say, listen, the guy you ought to talk to is Detective so-and-so. And I'll tell him, that I'll give him your name, and you give him a call a couple hours, and you can talk to him. And so that there's a couple of detectives in some of the smaller communities that I can talk to, these kinds of things. So you develop these relationships, and you use them. You
well,
know,
I'm going to have to do that for my next one.
Yeah.
Well, one of the stories that I'm writing for my next one is about a home robbery. Can't tell any more than that. And
yeah,
the
okay.
nurse in my doctor's office asked me if I would write this, because basically it's somebody that's tried to steal her house. It's a true story.
Uh-huh.
And she said she wants to be the detective that catches this person. So I thought that would be really cool. So
mm-hmm.
then my doctor, the doctor that day, it's an urgent care, but they're great. He wants me to kill off his mother-in-law. So he says, nothing doesn't like her. He says, this way he could get her to be quiet. I said, okay, I can
yeah.
do that for you, too. It was hilarious because everybody's giving me ideas. So there was another character that I liked. Tell us about Cousin Mordechai. He's cool.
Right.
And
yeah.
we have Clarissa. Tell us about Mordechai. He's funny. He's a good character.
Well, I can't tell you much about him because he's dead. And pretty much everything I know
yeah,
about Mordechai, you know, is in the books on the pages. He's a character that came to me as I needed somebody as kind of a foil, as somebody who was not as directly related as, and I mean, most of my cases, most of my stories have at least two cases going, two things going on. I'm writing a political thriller right now in which the detective is doing undercover work for a big corporation that's heavily involved in political, in making political contributions. And he's also working for, he's trying to find out who murdered a worker for a brand new political party that's starting in the area. It's all mythical stuff, of course, but it's kind of interesting because it's contemporary. So we'll see what kind of, Well, what sorts of political things are going to come up? I don't know. People say, "Well, how, you know, where's this story going? Who's going to be the bad guys?" I said, "I don't know yet because I haven't met him yet." See, and I have another friend who gets very impatient with me when I say things like that. He says, "I'm in charge. I'm the writer. Everything, every word, every incident, everything that happens to my characters, I'm in charge, and they don't have anything to say about it." And I say, "No, my characters talk to me. They speak to me in my brain." And they say, "You can't go down that road. That's silly. I would never do that as a character. So you got to take the alley or something like that." So I listen to my characters, and my characters frequently tell me things I don't understand until I've written a chapter, and they say, "Oh, that's why he did that." And people say, "That's crazy." Maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. So you don't know. See, I think it's kind of a mystical process. So, and that's partly why I enjoy it.
Because my characters are all dead.
Yeah,
my characters are all dead,
say,
and they have to tell me, you know, from the gravestone why they're there. Yeah, they're all
How
dead.
Do they do that?
But they've all did something wrong.
Well, so
they're all dead because I can't tell you how they got there, but. The main point of the story is that they get there because they've done something wrong to somebody, or somebody did something wrong to them. And I'm very proud because one of the stories in this book, and one of these stories books is called The Competitor, and it's about a baseball player that was angry because his somebody came into the league and they were going to undercut him as catcher of the team, and he was determined to get rid of this guy no matter what, and I wrote it with my nephew.
Nephew's
in baseball, so he gave me all the baseball stuff is right, and I co-authored it with him because Jake broke his pelvis, and he couldn't do anything, so I put him to work.
I see.
Helping
very
me
good.
Write the story.
Yeah.
And
that's very good.
It was right. It was not only was it good, but we didn't tell my brother that he was doing it until it was too late. It was published. So I'm hoping that I can get one of my other teenage son nephews or nieces to write. So, let's see. They come and check out Mordecai's apartment, and what is his connection to Catherine? This is what gets her in trouble, people.
Well, what gets her in trouble is that he's a relative, okay? He's a cousin, as I recall.
He's our relative.
Yeah, he's a relative. He's one of Catherine's relatives. And so, naturally, Sean has to pay attention to him. But because we live in a city where a lot of people are strangers, but a lot of people aren't. And the circles of connection are always there. And I go to events, okay? I go to like a museum event, an opening of a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to the gallery and I'll see three or four people that I haven't seen in a year and a half, but they're people I know. And that happens to everybody. And so, and that those kind of connections are useful to a detective, and they're useful to a storyteller because they allow you to weave a web around these characters that may have nothing directly to do with the main story, or they may have everything to do with it. It depends on how it all works out. So I just say, well, let's see where this goes. So Mordecai shows up when I needed a character, I needed to do something, and he provides, although indirectly, he provides a number of important clues to Sean so that Sean can go off and develop new leads to look at. and you find more people, and that's, you know, that's what all those characters do. A cop will say, well, you know, we're looking at so-and-so because of this automobile accident, and you ought to, the guy had a gun that we related to the robbery, and that's 6 years old. We don't know what the connection is, but it's there. And so Sean says, aha, and he sits down and thinks about that and figures out where the gun may have gone and figures out where it might be going and who might be involved. And so that gives him another character. It gives him somebody who is, you know, living in an apartment someplace, and you can look at this guy and say, who are his friends? Who are the people he has lunch with? Who does he deal with? And that all develops into more leads for him to look for these people. Then, of course, eventually, the bad guys get really tired of having Sean on their trail, so they decide to do him in. And he doesn't respond. He responds very poorly to that kind of activity, you know. So he gets.
Well, especially if you're going to hurt Catherine, he's followed her home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I would get angry too if anybody started up with my people too.
Well, see, that's
especially,
it.
Especially
that's
my guys and my nieces,
yeah.
Whatever.
Right.
So before I continue and tell everybody what, ask some more questions, I finished a book today. I finished it yesterday. I read one day, The Three Envelopes by Nir Tesroni, and it's coming out in April. And it's about a guy that's a mass criminal, mass killer. He's crazy.
Uh-huh.
You hear his words and you what he does to kill these people. He receives three envelopes. And he's basically supposedly only received one. And he belongs to this thing called the Organization. It's probably one of the scariest books I've ever read. And the character is 10483. And it's a debut novel, and I couldn't put it down. Then we've got Atone for the Ivory Cloud by Jeffrey Wells. These are some of my picks for the month. Of course, we have The Case of the Stolen Suitcase by Carl Brookins. I think you might want to read that also, people.
I hope so.
We've got The Marsh King's Daughter by Karen Dunn. I get all the ones these are the books that are not out yet. But the one that I just started, there was something in the news today about the Boston Marathon and the survivors. You want to read Marathon by Brian Friedman. He wrote this because of the Boston Marathon. What happens in Duluth when the cops are right there and people get killed. For the an American.
Yeah, I like Brian Freeman's
he's
work.
Coming
he's
on
a good
May 8th.
Good. Yeah.
Well, he good. Sent me that present the other day, and then he emailed me and said, when's my interview? So May 8th is Brian Freeman. I never know who's going to say what. I was just like, nobody. They just automatically go, well, she's going to do this.
Well, that's part of the excitement of doing
we've
these
we've got about
10
more minutes.
Yeah. Okay.
I have fun. I don't get paid, though. I should really tell everybody. I don't get paid to do book reviews. And I don't get paid to do the radio show. And I get royalties from my books when people buy them. And my magazine is looking for more writers, MJ Magazine. I have MJ9 is out. It came out 3 weeks ago. It's for writers, readers, authors. And we honored the memory of Florence Henderson in that one.
Good.
A big tribute to Florence Henderson.
Good. But in a way,
and
you do get paid.
The next one
I
hope to come
money.
Out in...
But you get satisfaction in knowing that you're helping authors find new audiences. Right?
This is true. And I'm glad you said that because my brother keeps saying, why don't you get paid? And I said, that would spoil my fun of doing it for free.
Are different kinds of payments in life. And you get the satisfaction
of
knowing.
Thank you, or your review was great.
Just
knowing that in 10 minutes after I post your review, there are about 100 people that are going to read it, for real.
Sure. And I want you to know how much I appreciate your taking time to talk to me about my books and my writing. You know, it's great. It's your audience.
So I learn a lot, too, by the way. I get to take notes while you're talking about how you do your books and how you outline and how you talk to your characters, because I'm learning, too. And it really does help. And then what happens is when I finish my books, then I have other people whose books I've helped to write a blurb for the back cover and pray that somebody's going to say, okay, we'll do it. Yes,
right.
We did.
We
and
will.
I did
and
get,
I will do it.
But I'm going to bother you too. Simon
I review books. I review mystery books, murder mysteries, crime novels for four different sites now, magazines and sites. And so if you write up, you write your books and you send
That's
me copies, I'll review them.
Well, that would be good because I could use some good press here, people. I did a blog tour for the book with Partners in Crime. They're fantastic for murder mysteries. They also don't charge $1,000,000. And they even after the tour, they blog your book. And me, every time I write a tweet or write something, everybody knows about it and everybody reads it.
Sure.
So
that's
Cheryl
good.
And Wendy and Gina are really great. And PJ's great, too, because she reminded you, which is good.
She's
great. She's I know. I love PJ.
She's good at what she
does.
So
I'm going to ask a few more questions. Where am I here? Who is Laura Lipp? And what is her connection? Who's Annette? Those two characters had me going, let me tell you.
Oh. I don't have an answer for you. They're just characters who came to me as necessary to be in the books.
Okay.
They were characters I needed
at
the time.
We won't talk about them.
Yeah. They may show up again. But they may not. Unlike Betsy and Belinda, who are the hackers, the people he uses when he needs some electronic stuff. But the others,
like that
too. I don't know. Are they going to be there? Aren't they? I don't know. Some of the characters because I need show up because I need an atmospheric situation. I need to put them in a situation where a normal person wouldn't go, like a CD strip joint or something. And we don't have any of those anymore,
oh, cool.
But we used to. but if he
you should go to 42nd Street, you never know.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it just you can't tell. So
seriously.
So. If I need him to do a certain kind of a scene, he needs a guide, not somebody to take him by the hand. I don't mean that kind of a guide, but there needs to be somebody in the scene who is familiar with the situation, who's there for him to relate to. He can't just be going around all by himself and talking to himself. You know, detectives do that, but they don't do it very often. So he has to have interactions with all kinds of people. And that adds to the weave, and it adds to the fabric. Go ahead.
I'm not going to ask a question about the suitcase because we're not going to find out what's in it, people.
Right.
I know you're going to find out that you found
it,
but we're not going to tell you what was in it or anything because that would kill the ending was too much for me.
Well, that would ruin the mystery.
You decided on. No, that would be moving, whether I figured it out or not. I'm not going to tell you. But I have to tell you this, that my cousin loves every book that I get. And she's getting this one this week, too. Because Susan wants anything that I say is really good, she demands it. I read The Fixer by David Baldacci. It's not out yet. And she took it out of my hand before I could even finish reading it. And she's going to want this one, too, and she's going to want a whole bunch more. But she's going to want the three envelopes, and I got an extra copy of that one.
Yeah.
And what else did I read? Oh, yeah, I'm going to be interviewing next month also, April 18th or something like that. Yeah, I think it is. Wendy Straub, Bone White. That was scary. So
she's a good writer.
Why does he normally get involved with I never read her before. It took me a while to read the book because it's got a lot of pages, people.
Yeah, it's a long book. Yeah.
But Emerson Monday, and the ending, you have to read this because the ending is amazing. They talk about the Sleeping Beauty murders, and she goes up against some detectives, this girl, and she catches you off guard with who's really guilty.
Who's
killing all the people that when this girl comes back. It's really good. So who started they were fired, they were victims, right? And there were people that were killed, but nobody cared. How come?
Oh, well.
Nobody cared. Why didn't they care?
People did care. They didn't care enough. It isn't, you're right.
Yeah,
that's,
I know.
That's a failing of the book. There is no real sense. Sean cares and Catherine mentions it, but it's only mentioned. It's not. There's no real sense of loss or people concern. Even though it appears that the people who are killed in the fire are not really nice people, but they're still people. They're still human beings.
Yeah, I know.
There should have been somebody should have had a little more concern about that. That's true. That's a failing. That's a weakness of the book.
Well,
but
you also have a police officer, Dan Brooks, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
How does he relate to Sean when he's on a case?
Well, he's just on a case.
Why couldn't he open it and why wait? So, how does he open? Yeah.
Well, he's just there. I needed a police officer for Sean to talk to. That's all. Most of these are characters that Sean needs to talk to or talk with. And some of them are people like Ricardo, his detective friend in Minneapolis. These are people that he can bounce ideas off and just talk to. And instead of having Sean conduct an internal dialogue, which is okay, but that could get boring after a while, he needs to have people that he can relate to. And sometimes he goes to people for information that he gets, and sometimes he doesn't get the information. And that's frustrating, but it gives me a chance to inject some dialogue and some movement, some physical movement in the books. You see, so there's forward movement. So there's always my readers are all saying the book you got to move things ahead faster, not necessarily to the solution, but you've got to have a little more action here. Things that may turn out to be dead ends, but you got to have more action. It's complicated.
Yeah, well, the one thing that's great is that if Sean succeeded right away and didn't get in trouble or frustrated, then it would be boring, because if something is too perfect and it's so easy to get to the end of the novel or the end of the book, and then he had no problem solving this case in 5 minutes, or I read a few thousand murder mysteries, and a couple of them I figured it out on the first page.
Yeah.
The first chapter.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah.
Then I said, and I was right. You don't want people to figure out who did it. You don't want them to figure out why.
If it's a true mystery
case, we can't.
Yeah, if it's a true mystery, there's got to be something that you want to read more and turn the page because you want to know what's in the suitcase, or you want to know who did it, or things like that. And if you know who did it, then maybe the what you want to know is how does the detective find that out and capture them? How does he bring justice to the scene? See, and sometimes that's what you get. So the books can have a variety of mysteries and solutions to them. And unfortunately, I think we tend to want to put them in boxes. And I don't think we should. I like to try to write books that don't have boxes. So you say, I can't categorize this. That's the trouble with this book. I can't categorize it. What kind of a book is it? Is it a mystery? Is it thrillers? Is it a PI book? Is it law enforcement? Is it just a novel? Well, maybe it's all of those. See, or none of them.
Yeah, well, the thing is that you don't want to. I've read books that have had like 10 plots, 5 subplots, and I prayed to. I got them all, but when I pull out my graphic organizer that I used when I was working with kids and teaching reading, then I was like, you're in big trouble. Because if I have to pull out the graphic organizer and start figuring out who did what to who, I still have a pile of them in
five. Well, that's
for
a little bit much.
36 years in the public school system.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no, too many
pages
in
the
book. I mean, there's some authors.
You can be complicated. That's right. You can be complicated, but you can't be too complicated. So that involves the skill of the writer.
Well, anything over 800 pages, and I know I'm going to take a snooze pill. But by the way, another good part about Carl's book says the print is large. That does help so much. Let me tell you. When I get these books that are 2 font and 1 font and they're 900 pages, I just put them aside and I can't read them.
I know.
And I
read
one that
right.
was good, but it took
me, the book,
usually it takes me like a couple of hours to read 400 pages. Yeah, this took me 3 weeks because I couldn't stand the print. So what is next for Sean? And tell us about how come everybody finds him cute? And Catherine better watch out because they're going to try to steal him anyway, even though he's short. Don't care.
Okay. sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Not everybody finds everybody cute, but
yeah,
sometimes
know.
They do. You know? And you do have to be careful. I find that that I have a tendency to write all my characters as looking like movie stars. I mean, not really, but you know, they're all. I don't have people who are too fat, or people who are too tall, or people who are too gangly, or they're just the only thing that's wrong with them is they kill people or things like that. And that's and sometimes you have to have people with physical deformities or something. Or you know, he had the skin on his nose looked like he'd been out in the sun for the last 40 years. Things like that. You know. There needs to be more of that. I don't say you have to write books that are just about those kind of people, but you have to be more realistic, it seems to me. I mean, I want my books to reflect more or less what society is all about, although, of course, there's still fantasies. I mean, you know, what you and I are doing is writing fantasy.
Yeah.
So we get to
well, I hope so,
plot our worlds any way we want them.
My character.
If we want our world to be completely peopled with good-looking people, well, that's the way it is. Of course, nobody will read it.
Well, I'll tell you. I won't tell you what I look like growing up. I changed my appearance a long time ago because it was necessary to disguise myself now.
Okay.
Yeah, when I was growing up, I was huge, and I'm not huge anymore. And my sister
well,
was
you're
a
healthier
size 2,
then,
and
you?
I was a size 18. I lost all the weight, and I lost my sister, unfortunately. And the reason I do book reviews is because my sister dared me before she died to review a cookbook, and I have no idea what the end of a stove looks like, unless a fork and a knife, unless somebody hands it to me, seriously. So, she conned me into reviewing books, and then she said, you should do radio, and then she would give me instructions about how I was supposed to speak and whatever. And I miss her because she edited all my books a whole lot better than most of the editors do.
She's not
here to criticize me anymore, but you know, when I tell her that I have great authors like you and others, I could see her up on top and, oh, maybe the sun will come out, because she also told me she controls the weather from wherever she is. So before we close, where can everyone learn more about you and what's next?
I have a website.
If Sean could say something to our listeners, good.
Okay. Most of my books are available through Amazon and other bookstores around the country. Barnes & Noble has them, and they're distributed, generally speaking. And I have a website. It's www.carlbrookins.com. People say, why don't you use a pseudonym? And I say, why? I mean, I'm writing the books. I want people to know about them. So I have a website, and all my books are listed there, and how to get them, and reviews and stories about them, and that's the best way to do it. That, you know, you just
do. You have a contact thing, so if I want to email you my brilliant review in about 10 minutes.
Absolutely,
there's a contact thing, so I can put the review in there.
Yeah, well, my address, of course, is carlbrookins@comcast.net. Carl Brookins is one word, but
okay,
you can
find
that email address, guess where? On my website.
Good,
seems
because they don't
me.
Give them to me when I tell them to.
No, right, they don't.
Okay, good, so I can do this.
They're afraid,
see
but
if
I'm
like
not
my
afraid.
Brilliance.
Yeah.
I hope so.
People say, well, we don't want to give out your website. You'll get all this email. I say, come on, I'll take the email. If I don't like it, I'll just erase it, you know. There's that big eraser button. It's easy to do.
No,
so,
I get them all. I get everybody. This has been fun. Thank you so very much. I mean, I have everybody's email, but I don't give them out. It's none of anybody's business. I don't do that. So once you give it to me,
good.
It stays with me. Thank you so much. I can't wait to read the next one and have another good laugh. And say hi to Sean for me.
I will.
And
say hi to all your
and
friends
everybody,
and relatives
it's
and your
so
characters.
Mean.
And we'll talk to you again, Fran. Have a good day.
And you too, and I'm going to say.
Okay.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Carl. Bye.
Bye-bye.